Hello and welcome to this week's Key Voices, conversations with folk in and around education. I'm Caroline Doherty. Today I'm joined by Mike Glanville, Director of Safeguarding Services, and Martin Baker, CEO of MyConcern. Martin and Mike had previous careers as senior police officers, and during their policing careers they had personal responsibility for both child and adult safeguarding in a variety of roles and settings, which in a roundabout way led to them creating MyConcern. Welcome, Mike and Martin.
Hi.
Hello. Hi, good morning.
Do you just want to say briefly a little bit about yourselves before we kick off?
Yeah, well, as you said, Caroline, this is Martin. I'm a recovering police officer. I'm also a long-standing school governor, and I'm a director of Multi-Academy Trust. So I've seen kind of the issues that we're going to be talking about this morning from the inside as well as from the outside. So really interested to have a chat this morning.
Great.
Yeah, hi, Caroline. Yeah, my name's Mike, and very similar background to Martin, senior police officer in Dorset for many years, and also a school governor. I'm a chair of governors at a very small primary school in Dorset, so, and have been for a number of years. So as well as the kind of policing experience, also get to see some of what goes on inside school with safeguarding as well.
Great. And can you give us a very quick overview of what MyConcern is?
Well, MyConcern essentially is an electronic safeguarding system, and it allows members of staff in a school to easily record safeguarding concerns, and then for the safeguarding lead in the school to be able to case manage those concerns. Mm-hmm. So they're able to link the concerns to profiles, they can upload documents and link those to the profiles as well. Yeah. And the system essentially is able then to store everything in one place securely, and they're able to then to see, really importantly, trends at a much earlier stage, because all of the information around a child is in the system. It produces reports on various categories of safeguarding, enabling the school then to be able to identify those really important trends. So that's essentially what the system does.
Thank you very much. Great. Would you say the levels of safeguarding concerns are increasing? And if they are, why do you think that is? What factors are driving it?
Well, I think there's a number of factors. I mean, they are increasing. Mm. I think we can see that from the data. So, I mean, if you have a look at children in need in particular, so these are children that are getting formal support through the local authority. Since 2013, there's been a significant increase in the number of children that are going through that process. And a lot more children now require help, you know, from the statutory agencies. So we're talking around about 400,000 children every year needing support. That's had a massive impact on schools. And in fact, if you look at where the source of these referrals are coming from, schools, you know, are responsible for around 18% of those referrals. That's around 120,000 referrals that are being made every year by school staff, essentially.
Yeah.
And particularly the designated safeguarding lead. And everyone inside a school knows that if you're completing a referral for a child in need, that's not a 5-minute job. That's going to take some time. So we know since 2013 there's been a big increase. We also know there's been a lot more guidance.
Yeah.
So if you talk to safeguarding leads, they will tell you there's a lot more guidance than ever coming from government. And a lot of that is statutory, so there's things they have to do.
Yeah.
And of course, keeping children safe has kind of grown in size now as well. I mean, we're talking about 150-page documents, so there's a lot in there for safeguarding leads to think about. So again, I think in terms of their responsibilities, that's changed massively, I think, in the last 5 years or so. I think the other significant thing is social trend. You know, the stuff that safeguarding leads were dealing with 5 years ago, it's now a lot different. You know, we've seen a big impact in and around online safety, for example. So, you know, offences that are now suddenly appearing on the statute books, like grooming and sexting and upskirting, well, they didn't exist 5 years ago. So that's, I think, also having a big impact as well.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. The breadth and range of issues that schools are having to deal with outside what traditionally might have been considered core child protection are absolutely huge now. and issues related to people not being able to feed their children, clothe their children adequately, keep them clean, all those kind of parenting issues are now landing on the doorstep of the school firmly and squarely.
Yeah.
And it forms a part of the new Ofsted inspection framework, you know, this cultural change to looking at the pupil as a whole and not just looking at the stats, but actually looking at the pastoral care, well-being and safety of those children, a key component now of Ofsted inspections.
And do you think actually schools are better at identifying, making those referrals? Do you think that's driving the numbers as well?
I think they're much better at doing that. I mean, a big emphasis of keeping children safe is early help. So, and of course, the schools are under a lot of scrutiny now. So they need to make sure that they're in a position to be able to identify children at a much earlier stage. Mm. And if we go right back to 2013, kind of, you know, a well-known case study is Daniel Pelka, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, back in 2013. And I think from that, there are a lot of lessons learned. And one of the big issues, I think, from that case was staff, particularly in school, being in a position to better identify, if I can call it, low-level concerns, and then build up a picture around an individual child and understand what those risks are. So I think there's much more focus now than ever on being in a position to spot those, you know, those issues at a much earlier stage. But of course, what that means is that staff are having to record those things. Somebody needs to be in a position, normally the safeguarding lead, to then manage those concerns. So that's obviously creating a lot more work for individuals in the school.
And I guess the kind of caseload grows then, because some of these issues are going to be difficult to resolve. So you have people at the further end of the spectrum and the new ones that you might be adding on in that early help category. We touched on it briefly there, but I mean, what do you think have been the main changes to safeguarding policy and practice in the last, say, 10 years?
I think the big change really is, I think, in and around the role of the designated safeguarding lead. So if you look at keeping children safe and look at the last 4 or 5 years, there's a lot more responsibility being placed on the shoulders of those individuals taking on that role. And if we were to go back 5 years, you'd probably have one person in a school taking on that role. And now you've got teams of people taking on that role. and in some schools you will have dedicated people that, you know, that is their day job. They will be taking on that role full time, Monday to Friday. So I think that's a big change. I think the Ofsted framework, so there's a lot more focus as well in the Ofsted framework on safeguarding. Big focus on the culture in the school. So I think there's much more emphasis on leadership and on governance in terms of creating that culture of vigilance, which Ofsted are obviously looking for. So I think that's, again, another factor, you know, the kind of increased levels of scrutiny that are now being placed again on these individuals inside schools. So I think that's had a big impact as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was talking to a head teacher who has only recently had an Ofsted inspection at the school, and it was very clear that the tone of the conversation had changed with the Ofsted inspectors from the previous focus on numbers. And in fact, when the head was kind of rolling out numbers, he was being steered away from actually talking about the numbers to talking about those pastoral issues, the safeguarding issues, how they're actually supporting and protecting children in the school. So there's a real practical change very recently as a result of the change in the Ofsted framework. And when you look at some Ofsted reports around safeguarding, I was looking at one the other day for a big upper school where everything was outstanding with the exception of safeguarding, and that was and leadership and management. The failures in leadership and management that were rated as inadequate were all linked to safeguarding.
Right. Yeah.
So the school was absolutely exemplary in everything other than safeguarding, and it meant that the school actually was put in a category.
Yeah, well, it's so fundamental, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is huge, you know, and people are kind of sitting up and taking note.
And do you think schools on the whole have managed to keep up with these changes? What are the main challenges that the people who are actually doing these jobs face, and how might they overcome them?
I mean, I think broadly schools are doing a great job in keeping children safe. I mean, I think that has to be said.
Yeah.
I mean, and if you compare schools to other organisations, they're well ahead of the game in many respects.
Yeah.
You know, they're very well, you know, regardless of what system they might have in place in the school, generally speaking, schools, you know, have safeguarding as a very high priority. And there's, you know, generally speaking, good systems in place. However, I think there are challenges. And as we've said, I think the challenge is mainly around that role of the safeguarding lead.
Mm.
I think there's a lot of responsibility now being placed on the shoulders of those individuals. And trying to keep up, you know, with the demand that are being placed on those people is, I think, huge. It's a huge ask for schools, particularly in the context of, you know, budgets that have been obviously cut over the last 10 years or so.
Yeah.
So increasing demand, increasing responsibilities, much more complex as well, I think. You know, dealing with quite complex, difficult situations inside school. So I think the big question is, well, you know, are those individuals adequately trained? Are they adequately equipped with the skills to be actually able to deal with some of these issues that now they are expected to deal with? And I think that's really the big challenge facing schools and colleges.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. We've kind of seen over the years how parents and carers are far more willing to challenge schools over what goes on behind the school gate. So they're increasingly questioning how the school are working with the children, whether it's an educational context, whether it's to do with safeguarding, whether it's to do with behaviour. So it's a far more challenging environment as well. So the safeguarding lead, you know, keeping them up to date, and I mean resources like those provided by the Key, you know, are really important in making sure that people are up to speed and up to date with all the things they need to know, but in a way that they can actually take it on board in the limited time that they've quite often got to do it. And I think that's one of the major challenges, is the amount they've got to do, the amount they've got to know,
yeah.
and the limited time they've got to perform the role.
Yeah, I mean, one of the important, I think, roles of anyone that's in the business of managing safeguarding is the ability to work with other agencies, you know.
Yeah.
And that can be challenging, you know, actually working with the statutory agencies can be challenging in a number of different ways, you know. And I think, you know, practitioners now need to have a really good understanding, for example, of information sharing, you know, what they can and cannot share, the reasons for sharing that information. They need to have a good understanding of the legislation and the guidance. We know that that changed quite significantly last year with a new Data Protection Act and obviously GDPR coming in as well. You know, and whether you've been a designated safeguarding lead for 5 minutes or whether you've been a designated safeguarding lead for 5 years, ultimately, if you're being asked questions, whether it's in, you know, an Ofsted inspection or whether you've been called to give evidence, for example, in court, you know, we've come across quite a number of safeguarding leads that are now being called to give evidence, whether it's in the family court, you know, the magistrates court or a Crown court. And, you know, you suddenly become the expert in the room, don't you?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You know, you're giving evidence and everybody in the room expects you to have the answers. And quite often they will focus in on things like policy, procedure, you know, how do you formulate your decisions? You know, what's your rationale? Well, you know, they're looking for how you think about these things. So that's hugely challenging, even for the more experienced safeguarding leads. So I think the big challenge moving ahead is how do we get into a position where we can really properly professionalise the role of safeguarding leads and actually make sure they've got the right support for the future, because this isn't going to become less complex or less demanding.
Yeah.
You know, if anything, it's going to become more demanding, you know, particularly with the increase in technology as well, because that's just another layer of complexity.
Yeah, I mean, we've worked with some DSLs who've been put in incredibly difficult positions where they found themselves in court faced by a lawyer representing the family, a lawyer representing social care, a lawyer representing health, and the only person without any legal representation in the court is the designated safeguarding lead, who's now being called to account over cases that could be some considerable time ago. So their ability to make sure they've got the right records, they're able to produce those records, they can evidence their decision making, why they made those decisions. It's a lonely place, and it's a really challenging place. So giving DSLs the right guidance, development, opportunities, making sure they get the right training, making sure the job description actually describes the role that they're undertaking. Because quite often it's a one-liner in a huge job description.
Yeah, absolutely.
Will perform the role of designated safeguarding lead. Well, good luck with that.
Yeah.
You know, it is the truth, because it's actually really complex, and it's much more, even keeping children safe, the kind of tick list in there about what the DSL must do doesn't really adequately describe the skills, experience that you need, and therefore the training that could be required to make sure that you can perform all of those duties effectively. So it's a big ask.
Yeah, and you just mentioned there briefly the kind of working with other agencies, and presumably in some areas, where provision is stretched, you know, that must be a real barrier and real challenge for DSLs to get the support that they need from social services and,
and others. That is so true. I mean, we hear many times that actually agencies that schools want to refer young people to, whether it's community mental health services, whether it's to social care or whatever, they, because of losing their resources, have raised the bar in terms of referrals that they will accept. And we've actually had doctors referring pupils back to a school because they know the school has got a counsellor. There's nobody available in community mental health. So actually, they're now referring back to schools because they know schools sometimes have resources that might be able to help. So, for us, making sure that DSLs are really well equipped to understand, first of all, what the duties of the local authority are under Section 17, et cetera, for referrals, but also making sure that they've then got the tools to be able to record those referrals, if it's not accepted, the reasons why it wasn't accepted, and being able to record that. But also, for us, I think it's really important, particularly because we've both been and our school governors and so forth, actually getting the head teacher, if they're not the DSL, but also the governing body engaged in this conversation to say, we are trying to refer children to other agencies and we're being knocked back.
Yeah.
And actually, then the governing body having a conversation through maybe the local clinical commissioning group or the new local partnership arrangements in the wake of LSCBs being reorganised, but actually having a voice as governing bodies and saying, we've got a need here and we really need to express that need to you, LSCB, as a local partnership as it is now, and so that the quantity and nature of the demand can be properly identified, because schools are just can-do organisations.
Yeah, exactly.
So when stuff gets referred back, they just go, and get on with it.
Yeah.
But actually, that's not the long-term solution. The long-term solution is actually got to be working with those other partners to make the need really, really clear.
Yeah, and the advice I've always been given as well, being governor, is you need to get to the more senior person with a a message, a letter from the governing body, because if it's just about the point of referral, that practitioner conversation can run, or people can say, we're really stretched, or we'll see you in 3 weeks or whatever. You need to go up to the top of the chain. Do you have any other advice for governors on this issue?
I think really importantly, making sure that they are obviously overseeing the safeguarding arrangements and providing support to the DSL, because the DSL, as well as being scrutinised, needs support. And that's a really important function. And identifying, has the DSL got enough resources? Have they got enough time to be able to do the job that we're asking them to do? Because ultimately, we could all end up in court if this goes badly wrong, which is a very selfish way of looking at it. The most important consideration is actually protecting the child. But that's the role of the governor, to make sure that is actually happening in practice, and supporting the DSL to get those resources, whether it's internal or external. And for us, that is the key role, is both holding to account but also supporting. And it's a really important role.
It is. I mean, one of the really sort of important roles for a governing body is to know your school. And I think part of that is to know and understand the role of the safeguarding lead, and to actually understand what safeguarding trends are going on inside the school. I mean, it's so important to have that information, because it provides a lot of context potentially to teaching and learning outcomes as well. you know, if you've got a particular trend in the school, which is then impacting on the welfare of children, it's going to impact on potentially their outcomes. So I think that's just so important. And it's important that the whole governing body, I think, have an understanding, not just the named safeguarding governor.
Yeah. You know,
it's not just about that individual understanding what's going on. I think it's responsibility of the whole governing body, actually.
Yeah, and simple questions like how many referrals have we made in the last term?
Exactly, like you say, those top line numbers that can easily be shared. That aren't,
yes. They don't need to know anything about the individual cases, do
exactly.
they?
Absolutely.
But there's a lot of information they should know about, you know, general trend and in particular, as Martin said, you know, the role of the safeguarding lead, because they're there to support that individual.
And it tells you a lot, doesn't it? The number of referrals and the number that were accepted, the number were rejected.
Yeah.
You know, then you can really start teasing out some information as a governor about that sort of thing. And what we found really interesting, a lot of the feedback we've had about people using My Concern, but it will be the same. Provided people know that you're keeping records, that informal conversation with a practitioner in another agency, when they know it's actually being written down and recorded in an auditable system, the conversation tends to change a little bit from if they, you know, the scenario where they think it's kind of an informal telephone chat as opposed to a proper referral. No, it is a referral and I'm recording the decision.
Yeah.
And the reasons why. It changes the conversation.
Interesting. Well, I bet your governing bodies are glad to have you guys.
Well, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
We asked too many questions.
Where do you think, in terms of the future of safeguarding, do you have any predictions there?
I mean, I think there's something about technology. I think that actually, you know, what schools and colleges should be aiming for is the most efficient system they can have in place to manage what is a very demanding, I think, now issue for schools. So I think are the right systems in place, and I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think if you've got a good recording and case management system, I think that's, you know, now really important, regardless of whether you're a big school with lots of demand or you're a small primary in the middle of nowhere. I think the other big issue, and we've touched on this, is the kind of this role of the safeguarding lead. And I think if you look towards the future, I think some way or another there needs to be some thinking going on in terms of how we are helping to professionalise that role. And from a national perspective, you know, not just at a local level. It's just so important, because at the moment the training that safeguarding leads are provided with is very, very ad hoc, I would say. You know, it varies a lot between local authorities. There's no national standard in place for the delivery of safeguarding training, and I think that's a big weakness. And I also think we need to be thinking about things like the qualifications and the competencies that we expect these people to have. Yeah. You know, if we're expecting people to be managing on a day-to-day basis some really quite serious and complex issues, they need to have the support in place in that respect as well, I think.
I mean, the role of the Special Educational Needs Coordinator has long been recognised as a really vital role, and you need to get qualified to be able to do that, and you need to have proper accredited training. With the DSL, you kind of get anointed, it kind of goes with the job. And actually, as Mike said, I think we're really moving into a time now where that needs to be put on a proper footing with proper qualifications, and actually you need to be able to demonstrate that you can do the job rather than just being given the job.
And I guess maybe it's something that across a group of schools or a trust, maybe that sort of knowledge, expertise, sharing, that might look potentially different in the future with people specialising in different aspects of safeguarding or, you know, having, a, I don't know, somebody senior as a safeguarding lead. I think that's an interesting one to consider. And as you said, sort of technology for managing safeguarding, but also the increased safeguarding issues that are brought about by children's access to technology and younger entry into that technological ecosystem, definitely. We've covered off quite a bit of practical advice there for schools, but is there anything in terms of a final word of advice that you've got for our listeners?
I mean, for me, I think it's we've got this kind of saying, which is always begin with the end in mind, and I think part of that is have really good plans in place. You know, there's lots of plans in place in a school in and around you know, the teaching and learning and other aspects of life in a school, is also important that schools have got good plans in place around their safeguarding. You know, so what is it you want to achieve? You know, and having really clear objectives, understanding the context within which the school, you know, is. So that's really important. There's a term which has come about through the latest guidance, which is contextual safeguarding. I'm sure you've heard of it. And I think that's, again, to me, that's really important that schools have got a really good understanding of the context within which they're operating. You know, so if you're in an area and you know that in that area you're vulnerable to county lines, for example, it really makes sense that you have some plans in place to understand what the problem is, that you're talking to the right people. Mm-hmm. You should be talking to the local police, for example, about the trends in that area, because it, you know, there's a high, obviously, risk, or a very significant risk, that children inside the school could be vulnerable to exploitation, for example. So I think having a good plan in place is always a good start, I think. So having that as a kind of, you know, a kind of feature in the school, a safeguarding improvement plan or a safeguarding action plan that sits alongside the school development plan, for example, I think is a really sensible thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Two things for me: get a plan and get support. You know, because you do need to be really structured and have objectives in mind. Being reactive in safeguarding is only ever going to sweep up the mess, if I can put it that way. It really needs to be. How do we, you know, safeguarding is surely about preventing bad things happening or preventing the escalation of bad things, you know, and that requires a plan. So you've got to have a planned approach and you need to get support. I think it's impossible nowadays for a DSL in a single primary school to know everything about everything.
Yeah.
So actually collaborating with others, having people that you benchmark against, that challenge your thinking, actually get some friends around you, get some support around you,
definitely.
You know, rather than being, you know, the lonely DSL. So I think we think it's really important, get a plan and get support.
And as you say, it's the amount of accountability, responsibility that that person is attracting, but also the emotional drain of dealing with this caseload. As you say, that's not sustainable for people to have to carry that alone.
I mean, there's very little formal supervision in place for safeguarding leads. It's something that, you know, we talk to safeguarding leads a lot, and that's a big gap.
Yeah, and that's supervision in a clinical sense. That's not something kind of just doing
a
staff appraisal.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's making sure they're okay.
It needs to be structured, and it needs to be focused on, you know, that role.
Exactly, and all of the kind of comparable activities that you might do in medicine and psychiatry, in that way.
Absolutely. Yeah,
indeed. Well, thank you very much to Mike and Martin for your ideas and conversation this morning, and thank you very much for listening. Key Voices is produced by The Key, giving education leaders the knowledge to act. Members of the Key for School Leaders can access hundreds of articles on the latest issues in education at thekeysupport.com.